Commander Repard, Real 33. Now, the next thing then really is your next posting. What exactly was it? This was the Admiralty, I believe.
The next posting was to be the Assistant Director of Undersea Warfare in the Naval Staff Division and to work in the old Admiralty building in Whitehall. And this took place in the spring of 1963. And one of the first things that happens under those conditions is as we were not working any longer at Northwood, I lost my married quarter, which was the only one the Navy had ever given us. So we had to find somewhere else to live. And one of my naval friends at Northwood had been sent to be the naval attaché in India, and he had a rather nice house at near St. Albans, and so we rented that from him and went, in effect, kept it warm for him. Lovely place called Old Cuckman's, beamy sort of house. And I commuted to there from St. Albans Station, and because Peggy needed the car, I needed a little car, so I bought a little sports car to take me up there, an Austin Sprite, to the station. And being an old-fashioned sort of car by modern standards, it was very quickly stolen from the car park. And as the lads of the village who used to steal the cars in those days and pinch the radios out of them, the police knew which fields they were going to take the car to when they were stolen, so they found them taking the radio out of the car and got the car back very quickly for me. But it was one of the hazards of that sort of job, that you had to commute from wherever you happened to be.
Now, what exactly was the job? You were Assistant Director of
Undersea... Assistant Director of Undersea Warfare meant that I was primarily concerned... The Deputy Director was a submariner and was mainly concerned with undersea warfare from the submarine point of view. The Director was the overall man, so my responsibility was undersea warfare from every other point of view, dealing in anti-submarine tactics from surface ships, dealing in mining, mine warfare, and so on, how to deploy these things rather than nuts and bolts of how to make the equipment for it. And it was deeply interesting because I had been involved in undersea warfare, of course, during the war anyway, subsequently specialized in torpedo and anti-submarine warfare, which is why I eventually got this job. And I'd been to sea in a major... in fact, our best anti-submarine squadron to actually do the work in practice. One of the more unexpected things that happened was that I was sent in 1964, I think, to Canada because the Canadians had found a way of moving a surface ship more quickly over the open sea by having a hydrofoil underneath it. Now we know about hydrofoil in ferries and things like that, but it was a very new idea then, and it was thought that with the advent of the nuclear submarines, which had very high submerged speeds, that the ordinary surface ships plowing through the bouncing waves on the top would be left absolutely sitting. And the Canadians felt that if they could control the wings of the hydrofoil, in effect, to keep the thing reasonably upright, then they'd be able to go very, very much faster and be able to compete with these new nuclear submarines. So I went to the Great Lakes where this was being tried out, and I got there just in time to find out that the trial vessel had unfortunately reversed all its controls and turned over and sunk. So I didn't actually see it working, but the scientists were very pleased that the computer equipment in it had in fact remained watertight because it had all been plunged into plastic. The rest of the boat was in the bottom of the Great Lakes. And that gave me a chance to go around and see a little bit of Canada in that area. And as I had a godson there, I was intrigued to have the chance to go up a little bit north where Grey Owl wrote his stories about the beavers. And I walked across a beaver dam and found that the beavers had won against the motorways which had been built into that area because they'd blocked up the drainage tunnels under the motorways and the winter snows melting swept the motorway away. So 50 love to the beavers in that case.
Did you actually find out much about the hydrofoil? I mean, how far
I
did it go?
I found out how fast it went and how good it would have been if only. But unfortunately, the speed of the nuclear submarines was increasing all the time. The Russians were sending to sea increasingly large and increasingly fast nuclears. And the thought of a surface ship competing with them was really Cloud Cuckoo Land. One had to either pursue them underwater with other submarines, in effect killers, hunter-killer submarines, or you had to use aeroplanes and missiles. But during this period in the Undersea Warfare Division, I found that there were great political arguments.
Hang on, just before we go into that, can we look at the other personnel at the moment? Who was the deputy director and the director at the time?
Deputy director was Ewan Raikes, who became a captain. His father had been an admiral, I think, too. And the director was a man called Nicko Poland, whom I'd known for quite a long time. He was a captain. And as the naval staff reported up to the deputy chief of naval staff, who was an admiral whose name I'd forgotten, but a man whom I admired enormously, I found that in the future planning aspects of what I was doing, I was taking part in discussions of major strategy as well as major developments of weapons and the allocation of resources one way or the other.
Now, what did you think of Ewan Raikes and was it Nicko?
Nicko Poland. I shared a room with Ewan, whom I'd known for quite a while, and liked him very much indeed. I always have done. And I also had known Nicko before in another job, although, of course, he was senior to me and older than me. And I liked working for him. In fact, I thoroughly enjoyed this top level of the Undersea Warfare Division. It was deeply interesting to see how the decision processes were actually made at Admiralty level, how they fitted in with the Ministry of Defence, and where the politicians came into this thing, because eventually, of course, allocation of defence budgets and so on were involved. And I had another slant on this, because at the same time, my brother, half-brother, Dennis Haviland, was a very senior civil servant in the Ministry of Aircraft Production, I think it was called, taking decisions about whether or not we should go into Concorde or not, for example, and other fairly major political decisions, because he was a deputy secretary, which is one down from the top in the civil service rankings.
Now, how were Admiralty decisions taken? I mean, can you give us a little bit of insight into that?
It would be difficult to know what happened at the very top level, because, of course, I didn't take part in the detailed discussions of the top men, or indeed read the minutes of their meetings, which were necessarily secret. On the other hand, at a lower level, I found that the allocation of resources was very strongly influenced by a political appointee of Harold Wilson's, a man called Solly Zuckerman. And that his little team, think tank team, of operations research people and so on, were beginning to lean on the professional soldiers, sailors, and airmen.
Now, what was his position? Was he first lord?
I don't know. He wasn't a political appointee in that sort of position. He was an advisor, something of the sort we're seeing more frequently nowadays in the Alistair Campbell sense of Tony Blair's administration. And he had, obviously, the ear of the Prime Minister. And to the annoyance, I suspect, of some of the more junior ministers, he could go over their heads to the Prime Minister and argue his particular line. I find this happening in respect of which new anti-submarine aircraft we were going to get. Now, because my brother was involved with aircraft production, I knew that the line being taken by him was that we should convert the Comet aircraft made by de Havilland's into anti-submarine aircraft. And I knew from my ordinary contacts in the Ministry of Defence that the Royal Air Force wanted to have a French aircraft called the Brigue Atlantique. And it struck me that with the position of employment in the country and money and all the other things, that we should buy British if we possibly could. So I talked to my brother about the development of the Comet and found that it was a practical politics that they were advising. I had worried about a jet aircraft flying at low levels for a long time, but apparently that had been overcome from the fuel point of view. And so I wondered how I could influence the purchase of the British aircraft. And I found that I had an army opposite number who particularly wanted a tank, a particular tank. And so in discussion with him over a cup of tea one day, we decided that if I voted for his tank, he would vote for my English aircraft, the Comet. And that's what actually happened in practice. It was settled at a rather lower level than usual, at my level. And we decided to go down the Comet track. But this was a very small example of a much bigger argument, which was blowing up at the time I'm talking about, which was a strategic argument. How was British power to be exercised around the world, as we still were a world power at that stage? Were we to go to island bases, or should we have a strategically mobile task force, which of course would be based on ships? And in brief terms, the argument was that the Royal Air Force badly wanted to have the ocean, the bases, because they could land their aeroplanes there. And my knowledge of the Russian naval capacity and their ability to fire nuclear-tipped cruise missiles, in effect, would eliminate any island base in the first few minutes of any conflict. And what's more, they had enough of these submarines to eliminate all the island bases in the first few minutes of any conflict. And we did not have the capacity to detect these damn things before they fired, anyway. So I argued very strongly for the mobile task force. And then I found that there was a division right the way up into government level. At that time, we had a First Lord of the Admiralty who reported to the Minister of Defense. I can't remember his name now, but he felt very strongly that the mobile task force solution was the right one. But he found that Harold Wilson and the Minister of Defense were inclining in the other direction. And this led to a split in the naval staff. So the vice chief of the naval staff went actually, I think, behind the backs of the First Sea Lord, and certainly over the head of the deputy chief of naval staff, who was convinced about that the island-based strategy was no good. And we reached the point where the First Lord of the Admiralty, the political appointee of the Prime Minister, resigned. And not only resigned, but resigned so forthrightly that he left the Labour Party as well and joined the Lib Dems, because he felt that Harold Wilson's way of doing this behind his back with somebody else was not very attractive. I'd had a shorthand...
Who was the First Lord of the Admiralty?
I can't remember. Again, name's no good, but from the history books, I'm sure 1964 would be there. I found him a chap very easy to talk to, and he did get me to brief him on the capability of the anti-submarine forces and the potential for the... he had, of course, naval intelligence briefing, but I'd been in naval intelligence and knew a little bit about that as well. Then we had the First Sea Lord himself also resigned. And the naval staff, almost as a body, undertook to arrive in uniform one morning and tow the First Sea Lord's car down Whitehall, in the same way that when a commander-in-chief leaves his appointment at sea, his captains row him ashore from his flagship. And we've offered to do this. And the First Sea Lord, who I think by then was Admiral Luce, who'd been my commander-in-chief in the Far East, where I used to play tennis with him, absolutely refused to have any sort of publicity stunt like that, and said if we wished to say goodbye to him, 8 o'clock in his office in the morning in plain clothes. So there was no fuss made. People just acted on their principles and resigned. And it was a stirring time to be there, because these views were very strongly held. And somewhere down the line was the feeling that the RAF had been most terribly disappointed because their new jet fighter had been ditched. The development had been taken up to the prototype stage, and then the cost of it was turned on one side. It was too much. And there appeared to be some pressure to try and placate the Royal Air Force by giving them the island bases. But we did win the argument in the end, because it was an overwhelming one, and the intelligence and all the rest of it made it quite clear that we couldn't do that. And in any case, we couldn't afford, it transpired, to be a worldwide power anymore. We weren't prepared to put the resources in to try to be. So it was an interesting political time for somebody sitting in one of the desks there. And the job involved a certain amount of traipsing around and listening to what happened to the result of fleet exercises, the sort of thing I'd been doing from the Commander-in-Chief's level before. But here I was looking at it in the bigger picture from the naval staff point of view. And that I found deeply interesting as well. But the disappointment which I'd felt when I was passed over for promotion led me to put in my resignation while I was there.
And we'll come back to that, I think. Anything else about your sort of working, daily working, the sort of things you had to do while you were at the Admiralty?
The Admiralty, of course, shifts an enormous amount of paperwork. And so vast sheaves of bump would come in. But the one piece of paper we all had to jump about and deal with always arrived in a yellow folder. And the yellow folders indicated that there was a parliamentary question involved. And it didn't matter what was happening anywhere else in one's job. That had to, because it was yellow, it was seen at once. And one had to deal with that forthwith to provide the minister with the appropriate answer to some inswinger bowled by some backbench MP or whoever it was. Occasionally they came my way. Occasionally my boss, Nicky Perland, would say, "Oh, here's a googly being bowled at us. What earth are we going to say to this one?" But I found it stimulating to see how the Navy ran from that level of the naval staff. And I found it rewarding and extremely interesting to deal with the other services, and again with the civil service, although a different level of civil service to the one I dealt with in the intelligence setup.
Was there a divide and rule policy? There's some rumours of it in the 60s between the services. Were you aware of it?
The facts that I saw could certainly be interpreted that way. And I felt that the services were being manipulated for reasons which were not necessarily put in the front window. I cared less than nothing for the policy, which was in fact denuding Great Britain of its power to retaliate, or indeed even to react sensibly to people all around the world who were increasingly beastly to us. And subsequent history showed that we've had to denude ourselves in order to send armed forces to deal even with our NATO commitments, or our European Union commitments more recently. We now have grossly overstretched forces, in my opinion, and I notice that there has been a formal warning from the First Sea Lord and the Chief of Defence Staff that we no longer have the resources available to meet all the commitments put upon them, and that the, as usual, the pressure is on the individual sailors, soldiers and airmen to do more than they possibly can, and therefore that their private life is being influenced by this, and no doubt it'll be more difficult to recruit them in future. As it appears to be now, I see that we're recruiting German pilots to fly in the Royal Air Force, which, for someone who'd fought through the war, is not a very appealing prospect in principle.
Any other major policy issues that came? You mentioned the Comet, you know, the anti-submarine aircraft. You've mentioned the island bases versus mobile task forces. Any other big issues that you're aware of?
I think the only big issues were on the relative allocation of resources to build new mines, new ships, and develop new equipment for them. We, in the staff divisions, we produced, first of all, a staff target for new equipment, setting out what we hoped it should be able to do, and we had to get the professional scientists to produce their input for that. And eventually that was developed into a staff requirement, which was a souped-up version of a staff target. And then we would hope to persuade the naval staff to put that forward to the commission, to the levels where the relative money expenditure was going to be discussed. And one then had to argue the case from the tactical importance of it and the strategic importance of what we were suggesting, and to see that that fitted into the overall pattern of what the armed forces were expected to do by government strategy. But no, I think those were the only two events which actually stuck out that I was influencing or having a hand in.
And what about your day-to-day routine? How was that?
Day-to-day routine meant piling down from St. Albans area to get into the Admiralty. Unfortunately, whereas when I was in the Naval Intelligence Division, I was able to park my car on the Horse Guards Parade, and the jams were such that I could quite reasonably expect to get there at a predictable time. By this stage, in the latter part of the 60s, this was cloud cuckoo land driving into the middle of London, and therefore I went by train and tube. And the train service was much more reliable then than it is now. In fact, I went down to King's Cross, or no, St. Pancras rather, from St. Albans, and then by tube down to the Admiralty. And it took me from door to door, something of the order of an hour, which was not bad at all. The nuts and bolts of where one went for lunch. I remember vividly that every now and then I had the tremendous excitement of half a crown, 2 and 6 pence in the old currency, of buying a beef sandwich for lunch, which was really going it a bit. Or I could go up to Jermyn Street, which is not one of the cheapest areas of London, where there was a wall sausage shop still running at that time. And I could get 2 sausages, bangers and mash, in fact, for 2 shillings, which was extremely good value for lunch. But quite often, one couldn't get time for lunch, and I had to get down to the Admiralty canteen, which wasn't my idea of fun. I'd much rather go out and walk about and see the shops at lunchtime if I could. Getting home in the evening rather depended on what paperwork was on one's table and what priority there was for it, because if there was a parliamentary question, you didn't go until that was dealt with, whatever that meant.
Now, what was your actually working routine, though? I mean, was it a desk job, basically?
It was a desk job with hordes of paper and an office and secretaries, and some paper was secret and some wasn't secret, and some had to be handled in one way and some in another way. And some of the individuals concerned were cleared to see secrets up to a certain level and some higher than that. It was nothing like the security level of the intelligence division, but bearing in mind that we had had attacks by Russian spies on the underwater detection establishment at Portland, and we'd found that we had a defector actually within the Portland complex that I'd been involved with in another job, this was pretty simple stuff, straightforward staff work. Nonetheless interesting because of the political implications and the broader picture of the money.
Anything else about your time there?
I was beginning to run down mentally as far as the Navy was concerned and wonder what else I was going to be able to do afterwards. But of course I could do nothing about finding a job until I was given a release date. And the system found it impossible to give me a release date except to say they wouldn't let me out for 2 years after I had resigned unless I gave up my pension, which I resented administratively very much indeed. In the end there was what was called a golden bola, in fact an encouragement for officers to retire early and receive payment to do so just before I resigned, and there was another one just after I left. But because I resigned in the middle, I had 1/7 docked from my pension, which I did not feel chuffed about, as you would imagine, because it seemed to be some civil service minutiae which applied rather than common sense or even common justice. And this helped me, if anything, to detach myself from the Navy, which I'd loved as a career very much indeed.
And when did you actually put in your resignation? When did you leave the Navy?
I put in the resignation very soon after going up to the Directorate of Undersea Warfare, 63 or 4, early 63.
You said, yes, spring 63. So when did you actually leave?
Under the heading in the list of movements of officers, there is one called Termination of Commissions, Releases, etc. At the top of that list, Royal Navy, J.D.L. Repard, DSC, Commander. President, HPL Additional for Duty inside the Ministry of Defense for the Directorate of Undersea Warfare and Navy, and as Assistant Director, placed on the retired list, own request, 16th of April, 1966.
So you were there quite a while.
2 years. About the normal sort of time for a staff posting.
And
one-seventh of my pension lost for resigning, I felt was iniquitous. I still do.
Do you think there was any security implication on the idea of having a slightly embittered officer so within the heart?
I think it could have been if I had been slightly embittered to that extent. But I, at no stage, became embittered to the point that I was a nuisance. And Nico Poland, and indeed the chap I shared a room with, Ewan Riggs, both knew that. Had I been going round wearing a red tie and taking part in discussions in Hyde Park, perhaps I would have been shot out earlier.